Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, which is March 28th. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Patty Daniels, that's me, and Bob Wagner. Here's our first story from the front page.
Displaced residents find temporary home. Some from building end up at Relax Inn. By Tom Lurie, Sarah Watson, and Gretchen Teske. Lamond Lathan Burge is happy to have a roof over his head, but the 23-year-old isn't sure where he'll go after the city of Davenport vacated his apartment building on West 4th Street on Tuesday on advice of Shive Hatterley Structural Engineers. He spent Tuesday night in the Relax Inn on North Brady Street. Scott County made rooms available at the Extended Stay Hotel. The city notified tenants of the evacuation of Schricker Apartments at 401 West 4th Street and has secured available resources to assist in displacement, according to a Tuesday news release from the city's Development and Neighborhood Services Department. Per the apartment building owner, the current expected number of units vacated is 18. Notices tapped to the building doors told residents the building was being evacuated immediately and that with proof of residency, rooms were available at the Relax Inn from March 26 to March 31st at no cost. Pets are allowed. Shive Hatterley was hired by the City of Davenport and its report recommended the immediate vacate order based on the condition of a wooden wall believed to be a structural wall. Nicole Gleason, Davenport's Public Works Director and Assistant City Administrator, told the City Council on Wednesday night that recommendations from Shive Hatterley were that the building should immediately be evacuated because of the building's potentially unsafe structural conditions and could fully or partially collapse with little or no warning. Lathan Bird said he wasn't surprised the building was vacated. A couple of days after I moved in, I was hanging out and playing some video games and mice ran through my living room, he said. I didn't have a stove for 2 months, and then they installed a gas stove. Turns out I had a gas leak, and I had to have Mid-American Energy come and fix it. And it just felt like maybe the floor was sagging. It was weird. Lathan Bird said he didn't fault the city, but he was taken aback by the lack of notice. I came home and the stuff taped to my door said we had to be out by 4:30 p.m. Lathan Bird said Wednesday while he stood outside the Relax Inn. That wasn't a lot of notice. I just put together what I could, put it all in my car, and came here. Lathan Bird said he felt really bad for some of the people living in the apartment building who might not be physically able to move stuff. Courtney Jones, Senior Operations and Partnerships Manager for the City of Davenport Office of Administration and Finance, said, "Tenants will be allowed to retrieve belongings so long as admittance into the building is coordinated with the property owner. This really just puts a lot of stress on everyone," Lathan Bird said. "So when I got here, I was told I had only 1 day at the Relax Inn. Then we had to work out how long I could stay. I'll be staying at the Relax Inn through Sunday. After that, I'm not sure. I either have to move back in with my mom or have to find a shelter that will take me." Lathan Burge paid $800 a month for his one-bedroom apartment at the Schricker Apartments. "I paid my rent early, so now I'm really low on cash," he said. "Things are going to get hard for me and the other people who lived in that apartment. I'm just not sure what I'll be able to do." The Quad Cities Tenant Alliance, a part of nonprofit Quad City Interfaith, hosted a rally on Wednesday ahead of Wednesday evening's City Council meeting, calling on leaders to provide the tenants with security deposit and 2 months of rent by Monday to find somewhere else to live. This is another example of landlords' complete abdication of responsibility for the health and safety of their tenants, said Beth Longlet, a member of QCTA and Zion Lutheran Church. "The tenants are forced to find new housing in an already tight market without the means to do so. We've seen this over and over. Landlords rarely return security deposits in these situations. When tenants are displaced because of landlord neglect, the city should require landlords to pay tenants immediately. It should be a condition of having a rental license in Davenport, said Dennis Platt, a member of QCTA. One long-term resident of the Relax Inn described it as a last resort for people who cannot find permanent housing. That same resident, who asked to remain anonymous, said the hotel's owners try to help people and they are good people living here. She also said some of the residents scare her. Latham Bird said he received a scary early Wednesday morning. I woke up to a man and woman screaming at each other, he said. It was right outside the door. Then he started hitting her. It was disturbing. The Relax Inn has seen some violence and drug activity. Joseph Fitzgerald Dodd was arrested in October 2023 for a September 17, 2023 shooting at the motel and left a man injured. Also in September, a man was arrested for allegedly peddling multiple drugs, including crack cocaine, heroin, and meth, out of a room he rented. Local law enforcement agencies served 8 search warrants on rooms in the Relax Inn in 2023. All of those search warrants were related to the people staying in the rooms, not the owners, managers, or employees of the motel. The manager worked Tuesday at the Relax Inn, saying the owners work very hard to keep people safe. He added that the management can't turn away people based on how they look, and it is very hard to tell what people will do in their rooms. Multiple complaints about the hotel last year led to some inspections in 2023. The complaints range from trash left in rooms to dirty sheets to cockroaches. These inspections fall under the jurisdiction of the Scott County Health Department, according to the State Department's website. The county, through its General Assistance Fund, is paying for residents displaced from 401 West 4th Street to stay at the Relax Inn until Monday. We're a stopgap, said Lori Elam, the Scott County Community Services Director. Elam said the city of Davenport reached out to the county and nonprofits for help with relocation assistance for tenants. Every county has a general assistance fund, Elam said, which can be used for assistance with rent, utilities, transportation, and even cremation and burial services for people who need it. Elam said the hotel accepted payment from the county. Vendors must go through a process to determine eligibility. This is an emergency situation, Elam said. We were just trying to help get folks off the street quickly, and we were able to use the general assistance to do that. Elam said she was not aware of recent inspections, nor had heard concerns about the hotel. Back to you, Patty.
Thank you, Bob. And now we're going to go to some more news. Acts of violence kill 4 in Rockford. Suspect in custody after multiple people are stabbed. Written for us by, it doesn't say who wrote it, it's just Associated Press. Rockford, Illinois. 4 people were killed and 7 were hurt when a man went on a stabbing rampage Wednesday across multiple locations in the northern Illinois community of Rockford, authorities said. A 22-year-old man is in police custody and was being questioned, according to Rockford Police Chief Carla Redd. She said one of the people who was wounded remains in critical condition. My heart goes out to the families right now that are suffering a loss, Redd told reporters. She said the Rockford police received a medical call at 1:14 p.m., followed by additional calls for police and paramedics. We don't believe there's any other suspects that are on the run or at large at this particular time, Redd said. Right now, we don't have a clear motive as to what caused this individual to commit such a heinous crime. Not all of the victims found at multiple addresses in the city had stab wounds, and some and none were shot, according to Redd. Rockford police initially said 5 people had been injured. Corey Hilliard, a public information officer with the Winnebago County Sheriff's Office, told the Associated Press Wednesday evening that 2 more victims were among those hurt. 3 people died at the scene. The fourth died at a hospital. Police later identified those victims as a 15-year-old girl, a 63-year-old woman, a 49-year-old man, and a 22-year-old man. Their names were not released. Red said residents in the area were being asked to review their home surveillance camera footage for anything related to the attacks. Rockford's population is about 150,000, and it's 90 miles northwest of Chicago and about 120 miles northeast of the Quad Cities. The violence Wednesday came days after a teenage employee of a Walmart in Rockford was stabbed and killed inside the store. Today we are shocked by another horrific act of violence against innocent members of our community, Rockford Mayor Tom McNamara said. Now that the suspect is in custody, he continued, our primary concern is ensuring that our community members directly impacted by this violence are supported throughout their healing and recovery. The mayor wrote on the city's Facebook page that multiple jurisdictions were working on multiple crime scenes to develop an understanding of what transpired in an effort to prevent this from happening again. The suspect was arrested by a Winnebago County Sheriff's deputy after they were called to a reported home invasion, Sheriff Gary Caruana said. The young lady ran from him, Caruana said, of one of the survivors. She got some stab wounds in her hands and her face. She is in serious condition. One of the Good Samaritans stopped to help her out. He did get some stab wounds. He is being checked out. President Eric Patterson said he was struggling to make sense of the violence on his street. You can't rationalize this, Patterson told the Rockford Register-Star. It's almost like playing a video game, but it's reality. It makes no sense. It's like Grand Theft Auto. I'm going to run over the mailman here. I'm going to stab a couple people there. I am going to go in this house over here. Another resident, Vanessa High, told Rex TV in Rockford that the experience of witnessing the arrest was unreal, like a movie. All of a sudden, we heard police run up on both sides of the house screaming, stop, get down, High told the station. Then they ran into the backyard, and after a few minutes, we saw them bringing the suspect down the driveway in handcuffs, and he was very bloody. Cassandra Hernandez, another neighbor, told the Rockford newspaper that she is friends with one of the victims. You never expect this here, Hernandez said. We have such great neighbors.
And now we'll turn to local news. Deer to lay off 300 in Waterloo. Company's actions won't affect workers at Quad City plant. Out of Waterloo, more than 300 employees at John Deere's Waterloo operations will lose their jobs in late April, the company confirmed Tuesday. A John Deere spokesman said 308 production workers will be laid off indefinitely April 29th. Employees reportedly learned of the layoffs in meetings with the factory leaders Tuesday. John Deere informed members of the workforce at its Waterloo operations in Waterloo, Iowa, on Tuesday, March 26, that 308 production employees will be placed on indefinite layoff, effective April 29. Employees were told of the layoffs by factory leadership in meetings today, a Deere statement said. Each John Deere factory balances the size of its production workforce with the needs of the individual factory to optimize the workforce at each facility. John Deere Waterloo operations currently have about 5,500 total employees, with about 3,600 of them working in production and maintenance jobs. Numbers posted to the Iowa Workforce Development, WARN, standing for Worker Adjustment and Retraining Act, website also indicate 308 workers will be idled. The announcement comes 2 weeks after the company announced it will lay off 150 workers at its Ankeny location. According to recent earnings reports, the company made $10.1 billion in fiscal year 2023, and its projected earnings of $7.5 billion to $7.75 billion for fiscal year 2024. In February, the company reported net income of $1.751 billion for the first quarter of 2024, which ended January 28th, or $6.23 per share. That was down from the same period last year, when the company reported a net income of $1.959 billion, or $6.55 per share. The company announced February 28th that the largest, most powerful tractor it has ever made is expected to roll off the assembly line in Waterloo in mid-2024. The new 9RX tractor is a flexible swivel joint articulated tractor with four huge treads or tracks. The tractor can be fitted with 830, 770, or 710 horsepower engines. Out of Davenport, driver of a tow truck charged in a hit and run by Thomas Geyer. A tow truck driver allegedly was texting and driving recklessly when he struck and seriously injured a Davenport woman at the intersection of Rockingham Road and South Concord Street earlier this month, Davenport police said Tuesday. Granville Kelly Ramsey, 52, was arrested Tuesday and booked into the Scott County Jail at 11:23 a.m. Ramsey is charged in Scott County District Court with one count each of serious injury by vehicle and leaving the scene of an injury accident. Each charge is a Class D felony under Iowa law and carries a prison sentence of 5 years. He also is charged with one count of preventing apprehension obstruction of justice, an aggravated misdemeanor that carries a prison sentence of 2 years. Ramsey also was issued 10 citations for numerous traffic offenses, including running stop signs, driving with no hands, while using electronic device and not wearing a seatbelt, among other offenses. According to the arresting affidavit filed by Davenport Police Officer Robert Cormier, officers responded to a hit-and-run crash at Rockingham Road and South Concord Street at 11:34 a.m. on March 13th. Officers located a victim identified as Dana Oswald Evans, 43. According to the affidavit, Evans suffered a fracture to her right femur, a pelvic fracture, a left pneumothorax or collapsed lung, and several rib fractures. Using surveillance video from nearby businesses, officers were able to identify the vehicle, a 2016 Freightliner tow truck. Officers located the tow truck in a nearby tow yard. The tow truck was equipped with two cameras, one that faced out of the front windshield onto the roadway, and one that faced the driver in the cab. Ramsey was identified as the driver of the tow truck by the video from the cab and by co-workers. According to the affidavit, he also admitted to driving the truck. From the cab video, officers saw Ramsey using and texting on his cell phone while operating the tow truck before striking Evans. According to the affidavit, Ramsey knew he had struck Evans and fled the scene of the crash. From the video, officers could see that Ramsey was not wearing a seatbelt for the entire drive. More than 3 miles, from 1300 Emerald Drive to the tow yard at 941 South Rolfe Street, the location of Action Towing and Auto Repair. The video showed Ramey running stop signs at five intersections, West 13th Street at Calvin Street, Telegraph Road and Waverly Road, Clark Avenue and Indian Road at Concord Street, and Concord Street at McKinley Avenue. Video from the tow truck showed Ramsey making an improper turn at Rockingham Road and South Concord Street, where he failed to yield to Evans, who was walking in the crosswalk and had the right of way. The tow truck also was not completely to the right of the center line while turning. Ramsey gave consent for police to search his cell phone. This is when officers discovered that Ramsey had destroyed text messages and phone call records after the crash to allegedly hide the fact that he was using the phone while driving. During a first appearance on charges Wednesday in Scott County District Court, Magistrate Stephen Wing scheduled a preliminary hearing in the case for April 5th and set Ramsey's bond at $5,000 cash or surety. Ramsey was released from the Scott County Jail after posting 10% of the $5,000 bond through a bonding company.
Thank you, Bob. Attorneys to look over solar plans. This is from News Tracker, Geneseo. What we know, Geneseo aldermen voted to learn more about a proposed second solar array last month. Tim O'Malley of Renewable Support Services of Rock Island gave a presentation on his firm's plans for Geneseo on Tuesday. RSS would develop, engineer, construct, and operate a 2-megawatt solar generating facility on 15 acres. The new panels would track the sun throughout the day. That technology has come a long way since you built yours in 2015, he said. According to O'Malley, the new solar array would allow Geneseo to keep the average cost of energy at under 4 cents per kilowatt hour, O'Malley said. He called Geneseo very unique in its ability to have independent electric generation and added the solar array would enable the city to remain as independent as possible. The goal would be for Geneseo to purchase the facility from RSS in the sixth year of operation. Right now, the city's current bond payments of $630,000 per year do not allow the city to take on any more debt. The city is estimating its bond payment for the new solar array years from now would be $225,000 after bonding for $1.8 million. This opportunity for us makes the most sense, said Eric Rowald, Director of Electrical Operations. With our bonds that we currently have, we're unable to do it ourselves. The plan hinges on obtaining renewable energy credits worth $1 million from the Illinois Shines Program. RSS would apply to the program. As a municipality, the city can't fully utilize or receive the tax credits, and if it had no more capacity for a certain year, the project would get moved to apply for the next year. O'Malley said the initial cost of energy for Geneseo would roughly net 2 cents per kilowatt hour. The new solar panels would be 650 watts compared with the existing 1-megawatt solar farm's 290 watts. The facility would have an expected lifespan of 35 to 40 years. Mayor Sean Johnson reminded the council that the current array is still providing good service. Just because technology changes and things get better, it's still very beneficial to the city, he said. Alderman approved a motion to have attorneys at Ansel Glink, who specialized in solar energy, look at the purchase power agreement and the financials. Alderman James Roodhouse, 2nd Ward, was absent. Attorney Dirk Price said the cost wouldn't exceed $3,000. What's next? Alderman also approved recommending to council a 2-year agreement with the farmers market to operate on Pearl Street just north of the city park. The market runs every Saturday starting the last week in June through the end of October. No money will change hands in the agreement. And then one more, we have the Henry County Circuit Court. Staffing issues push back trial. Roshan Strotter is charged in 2022 death of 14-month-old. Written for us by Lisa Hammer. Cambridge, a bench trial on a murder case for a Kelowna man charged in Henry County, has been pushed back. It had been scheduled for late April. Roshan M. Strotter, 39, charged with aggravated battery and murder for the January 30, 2022 battering death of a 14-month-old girl, appeared Wednesday at a status hearing in Henry County Circuit Court. Strotter appeared before Judge Daniel Dalton. Strotter's attorney, public defender Lance Camp, said he and state's attorney Catherine Runty had spoken together and both agreed that timing was not going to work out for a bench trial as scheduled at the end of April. Camp said his lack of assistance in the public defender's office meant he was not going to be adequately prepared for trial, and he said Runty had the same problem with being short-staffed. The judge granted a motion to continue the case. The attorneys will contact the court administrators to set another status hearing and confer on possible trial dates. On January 27, 2022, Kelowna police were notified of an aggravated battery to a child by the Moline Police Department. The Moline Police Department took the initial report, believing that the battery had occurred in Moline. An investigator from Kelowna met with Moline investigators in Moline, leading to the charges filed on Strader. The child was initially flown to OSF St. Francis Hospital in Peoria, where she died. After the hearing, Runty declined to give the name of the child. Strader is being held in the Henry County Jail on $1 million bond.
Now a turn to Kelowna. Aldermen look into police shortage, by Lisa Hammer. What we know, Kelowna has had trouble keeping police officers, and it's running up overtime budget because of a lack of officers. What's new? Aldermen on Monday discussed amending the city's ordinance for lateral transfer of police. The proposed changes would include giving officers who served other departments up to 7 years credit for their prior experience. That change would be for payroll only, not in terms of department seniority. The council also talked about creating a lateral transfer bonus. It would require that an officer remain with the department for 3 years or be required to pay the bonus back. No decisions were made. What's next? Mayor Don Rupp reported there has been no interest in the city clerk position, which has been filled by an interim since late last year. Aldermen discussed withholding a referendum to make the position an appointed one rather than an elected one. They also discussed raising the pay from the current $4,800 per year. It's hard to get a clerk in here for that kind of money, Third Ward Alderman Mike Painter said. It's not hard. It's almost impossible. They agreed that an evaluation needs to be done on the entire staff situation at City Hall as a whole to ensure all responsibilities are covered. The Finance Administration Committee received a list of all duties, but will put the issue on its agenda again. The city is also looking for a new building inspector as they are losing service from the Silvis inspector. The mayor said efforts have been made to piggyback with another city inspector, but that has not been fruitful. And one last article out of Bettendorf, Woman Charged in Teen Shooting by Thomas Geyer. A Bettendorf woman has been arrested for allegedly shooting a teenager in the foot during an altercation on Wednesday, Bettendorf police said. Tanasha Dominique Robinson, 32, was arrested on one count each of intimidation with dangerous weapon and willful injury causing serious injury. Each charge is a Class C felony that carries a prison sentence of 10 years. Robinson also is charged with assault while displaying a weapon, an aggravated misdemeanor that carries a prison sentence of 2 years. According to the arrest affidavits filed by the Bettendorf police officer Brian Payton, at 2:41 p.m. in the 2800 block of Hawthorne Drive, Robinson became involved in an altercation with a 17-year-old. Robinson went to her home and retrieved a firearm, a 9mm handgun. She returned to the altercation and shot the 17-year-old in the right foot, causing serious injury. Robinson then returned to her residence with the gun. Officers located a silver 9mm shell casing where the shooting took place. Police served a search warrant at Robinson's residence, according to the arrest affidavit. Officers located a locked safe. Upon opening the safe, officers seized a 9mm handgun loaded with the same brand of silver-cased 9mm ammunition as the casing found at the shooting scene. Robinson was being held Wednesday night without bond in Scott County Jail. She's expected to make a first appearance on the charges Thursday in Scott County District Court when a judge will schedule a preliminary hearing and set bond. Back to you, Patty.
Thank you, Bob. It is time for us to read the obituaries. I'll start with the pendings. Stephen D. Brenner, 60, of LeClaire, passed away Sunday, March 24th at Genesis Medical Center East, Davenport. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline. Lisa Buchheit Williams Silverthorne, 57, of Eldridge, passed away Tuesday, March 26th at her home in Eldridge. Services are pending at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Sharon Nadine Coulter, 79, of Geneseo, passed away on March 26th at her home. Vandemore Funeral Home, Geneseo Chapel, is assisting the family with arrangements. Donald Don L. Dyer, 65, of Bettendorf, passed away Sunday, March 24th, at his home. Arrangements are pending at Van Ho Funeral Home, East Moline. Gladys M. Hintz, 97, a resident of Davenport, died on Tuesday, March 26th, at her home. Arrangements are pending at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Neil Keeney, 70, of Maquoketa, passed away on Saturday, March 23rd, at home. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Dwayne Kidd, 89, of Welton, passed away peacefully at home Tuesday, March 26th. Arrangements are in the care of Schultz Funeral Home, DeWitt. Sally Ann Powell, age 88, of Annawan, Illinois, passed away on Thursday, March 20. Arrangements are pending with Vandemore Funeral Homes and Crematory, Atkinson Chapel. Margaret Peggy Jane Terry, 91, of Morrison, Illinois, died Tuesday, March 26, at Pleasant View Nursing Home in Morrison. Arrangements, Vosma Renke's Funeral Home in Fulton, Illinois. And William Sigler, January 9, 1936 to March 25. William Bill Mick Sigler, a devoted husband, father, grandfather, and brother, passed away on March 25th at his home. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, April 4, at St. Peter Catholic Church in Buffalo. Burial will follow with military honors at National Cemetery, Rock Island. The family will greet friends on Wednesday, April 3rd, from 4 to 6 p.m. at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to St. Peter Catholic Church or St. Joseph's Indian School, P.O. Box 326, Chamberlain, South Dakota, 57326. William was born on January 9, 1936, in Kyoto, to George Verl and Agnes Snyder Sigler. He proudly served his country with the United States Air Force. Bill married Patricia Van Camp on August 4, 1984, in Davenport. He worked at Alcoa Davenport Works, retiring after 32 years. He enjoyed traveling, especially to Arizona. He loved woodworking and made many beautiful pieces. He also loved his Hawkeyes. Bill was a member of St. Peter Catholic Church and American Legion Post 711. Bill leaves behind his wife, Patricia, children, William, bonus daughters, Corey of Mesa, Arizona, and Kimberly DeBain of Charlotte, North Carolina. Bill's legacy extends to his grandchildren and great-grandchildren. There's a whole bunch of them. I'm not going to read them all. He is also survived by his sisters, Mary Jean of Kalawassee Island, South Carolina, and Kathy Ewald of Kyoto, Wanda Ballou, brothers Henry Sigler of Kyoto, and Carl Sigler of Kyoto. Bill was preceded in death by his parents, George and Agnes, sisters Annie, Carol, Bonnie, Georgia, Joyce, and Cindy, brothers Harold, Daryl, Raymond, Thomas, Donald, Robert, and James, his father-in-law, Charles Van Camp. The Sigler family expresses heartfelt gratitude to Genesis Hospice for their compassionate care, and especially by Bill's care team, Angie, Kim, Jennifer, and Pastor Ken.
Thank you, Patty. And to continue on with the obituaries, out of Bettendorf, Jane L. E. Miletich. Jane E. Miletich, 65, of Bettendorf, passed away on Tuesday, March 26, at Genesis Medical Center East Campus, Davenport. Visitation will be held from 11 to 1 p.m. on Friday, March 29th, at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home, Bettendorf. Per Jane's wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. Memorial may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be shared with Jane's family at www.mcginnis-chambers.com. Out of Davenport, Dolores Burmeister. Dolores Burmeister, Mrs. B. of Davenport, passed away on March 23rd at Unity Point, Bettendorf, surrounded by her family. Visitation will be Monday, April 1st, 2024, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Holligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home, with a rosary recited at 6:30 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 2nd, at Sacred Heart Cathedral, 422 East 10th Street, Davenport, with visitation an hour prior to the service. Burial will be in Davenport Memorial Park. Online condolences may be made to the family by visiting her obituary at www.hmdfuneralhome.com. Brad Early. Brad Early, 61, of Davenport, died Sunday, March 24th at Genesis East, Davenport. Keeping his wishes private, family services will be held and cremation rites will take place. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the family. Hazel McBride. Hazel McBride, 99, of Davenport, passed away Tuesday, March 26, at Clarissa C. Cook. She was surrounded by family and loved by so many. Visitation will be held on Monday, April 1st, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Rung Mortuary, followed by a funeral service at 12 p.m. She will be laid to rest in Davenport Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials may be made in her honor to Faith First Community Church. Online condolences may be expressed at www.rungemortuary.com. Stephen Brenner of LeClaire. Stephen D. Brenner, 60, of LeClaire, Iowa, passed away Sunday, March 24th, of pulmonary fibrosis. He was surrounded by his wife and family. Per Steve's wishes, he will be cremated and there will be no celebration of life. Jolene Galen. Jolene Galen, 89, of LeClaire, Iowa, passed away peacefully on March 25th with her daughters by her side. A visitation will be held at the LeClaire Baptist Church, LeClaire, Iowa, at 1 p.m. on Saturday, March 30th, 2024, followed by a funeral service at 2 p.m. Jolene will be interred beside her parents in the Mount Hope Cemetery in Fousland, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorial contributions be made to the LeClaire Baptist Church or any organization that serves and supports children. Online condolences may be shared at www.mcginnis-chambers.com. And in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Janelle Renee Gagnier died March 15, 2024, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. A celebration of Janelle's life will be held in the community room at the Friendly House, 1221 Myrtle Street, Davenport, on Monday, April 1st, from 5 to 8:30 p.m. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting www.hmd-funeralhome.com.
There's an article here about another death. Former Senator, VP candidate, dies at 82. This is Joe Lieberman. New York, former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who nearly won the vice presidency on the Democratic ticket with Al Gore in the disputed 2000 election, and who almost became Republican John McCain's running mate 8 years later, has died, according to a statement issued by his family. Lieberman died Wednesday in New York City from complications from a fall, the statement said. He was 82. The Democrat-turned-independent was never shy about veering from the party line. Lieberman's independent streak, and especially his needling of Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama during the 2008 presidential contest, rankled many Democrats, the party he aligned with in the Senate. Yet his support for gay rights, civil rights, abortion rights, and environmental causes at times won him the praise of many liberals over the years. Lieberman came tantalizingly close to winning the vice presidency in the contentious 2000 presidential contest that was decided by a 537-vote margin victory for George W. Bush in Florida after a drawn-out recount, legal challenges, and a Supreme Court decision. He was the first Jewish candidate on a major party's presidential ticket and would have been the first Jewish vice president. We'll turn now to the opinions. Trump VP less likely to be Rubio than Taylor Greene. Written for us by Jonah Goldberg. Now that Donald Trump is officially the presumptive Republican nominee, he's getting ready for the general election. He installed new leadership, including his daughter-in-law, at the Republican National Committee. His campaign is in talks with his former campaign manager and pardon recipient, Paul Manafort, to run the GOP convention. And his lawyers have successfully reduced a nearly $500 million bond in his fraud case to a more manageable $175 million. Yep, everything is shaping up as well as can be expected for Trump's fourth run for president, including his short-lived 2000 effort. The last big thing on his list, pick a running mate. In case you haven't heard, his former vice president, Mike Pence, is not available. Picking a running mate is a lot like buying a car. The first question is, what do you need it for? If you need to haul around a bunch of kids, a minivan might be best. If you want to show off, a sports car makes more sense. VP picks are for shoring up weaknesses or reinforcing strengths. Trump picked Pence in 2016 because he needed to reassure social conservatives and evangelicals. Biden chose Kamala Harris because he believed, wrongly in my opinion, that he needed a black woman on the ticket. So what does Trump need in a running mate? His claims of uniting the GOP notwithstanding, he needs to deal with the reality that a quarter to a third of the party backed Nikki Haley and other alternatives in the primaries. One way to do that is to win those voters back. Another is to replace them with supporters who haven't traditionally voted Republican, including working-class black and Latino voters. A third option, cobble together chunks from columns A and B. The question is, can a running mate help him do any of that? Trump has 100% name identification. The idea that a sidekick could change voters' opinions about him seems implausible. Unlike in 2016, Trump may not have reason to shore up portions of the base with this decision. The voters Pence helped bring into Trump's coalition are now, for the most part, fully loyal to him. Those who aren't won't change their minds based on a potential VP. Hence my skepticism that picking a woman would shore up Trump's weaknesses with female voters. Women who don't like Trump or who are highly motivated by the abortion issue aren't likely to be swayed by a female running mate. There's also the matter of Trump's personal preferences. He now values blind loyalty and even blinder sycophancy more than electoral appeal. He's convinced that he's popular and he wants someone to hype his greatness. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who implored voters not to vote for a con man like Trump in 2016, now says he would be honored to be his number two. Picking Rubio would make a lot of political sense. He's a gifted and extremely flexible politician who could appeal to college-educated suburbanites and to working-class and Latino voters. But I think Trump and his advisors understand that if he is elected, he could easily be impeached again. In that light, selecting a conventionally reassuring politician as his constitutional understudy is risky. If removing Trump from office would result in a President Rubio or even a President Tim Scott. A lot of Republicans might take that bargain. What I believe Trump wants is a Renfield to his Dracula, a toady who is totally subservient. Such a creature like Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, would not only campaign the way Trump wants, but would also make the price of removing him from the White House too scary to contemplate. Greene might be too much of a liability to make the cut, but I suspect he will be drawn to a pliant enabler who is frightening enough to backstop his presidency while not so outlandish as to cost him the election. U.S. Representative Nancy Mace, stay near your phone. And by the way, Goldberg is editor-in-chief of the Dispatch.
All right, thank you, Patty. And let's catch up on some NCAA tournament news in our sports. Illinois-Iowa State target Elite Eight. In a subtitle, UConn and South Dakota State University set for championship rematch in Sweet 16. Out of Boston by Kyle Hightower. The East Regional Semifinals in the NCAA tournament features a matchup between second-seeded Iowa State, which has the best defensive rating of remaining teams, against number 3-seed Illinois, which boasts a top offensive rating, according to Ken Pomeroy's efficiency ratings. Both are also among six remaining Sweet 16 teams with Final Four appearances, but no titles. Iowa State's only Final Four berth was 80 years ago. Coach T.J. Otzenberger said the Cyclones' old-school 57-53 victory in January over Houston was emblematic of the type of defense-first mentality that has served them best this season. You also feel so great in the locker room after all those sacrifices, all that hard work, all that unity, all that time you beat the number 2-ranked team in the country, Otzenberger said. I truly believe that gave our guys a greater sense of purpose and confidence. Illinois hasn't been to Final Four since 2005 and has been relying on its unorthodox booty ball offensive actions aimed at getting different post-ups and matchups. It also revolves around the camaraderie of a group that wasn't above embracing luck as it entered a venue adorned with shamrocks. When senior forward Coleman Hawkins walked into the news conference along with teammates Marcus Damask and Quincy Guerrier, he noticed their name placards were in an order different than where they'd sat in their previous media sessions. He quickly changed them. Superstitious? The moderator asked. Little bit, Hawkins replied. But perhaps the biggest reason for the Illinois success on offense has been senior guard Terrence Shannon Jr., who is averaging a team-high 23.3 points per game and scored 56 points in the Illini's first two NCAA tournament wins over Morehead State and Duquesne. He's done it playing most of the season under a cloud after being charged with rape in September. Shannon played in Illinois' first 11 games before the university suspended him from team activities when the criminal charge was filed against him. He returned after six games when a federal judge intervened, ruling that his civil rights were violated by lack of due process. He hasn't spoken to the media since then and was again unavailable for interviews on Wednesday. Coach Brad Underwood said his team has done its best to adjust. I've said all along I was going to coach the guys I had in the locker room, Underwood said. I wasn't going to be the best supporter of those guys that I coach every day. We had to find a way to flourish through those tough times. Then, when he came back and joined us, he was a part of our team again. He has always been a great teammate. We got him back, and here we sit today. UConn-San Diego State match set for rematch. Connecticut coach Dan Hurley won't shy away from the notion that his team has consistently been the best in college basketball this season. The Huskies' 33-3 record and the dominant manner in which they've won along the way have proven that. He also knows that means next to nothing as they return to the Sweet 16, still four victories away from becoming the first team since Florida in 2007 to repeat as NCAA tournament champions. We're not going to be able to trade that in for anything tomorrow night versus a team we faced last year in the finals, Hurley said. Wednesday as his team prepares for its East Regional semifinal matchup against a fifth-seeded San Diego team that it beat in the NCAA title game last April. But we bring the confidence. We believe. We think we're supposed to win these games. The Huskies have reason to feel that way, having won each of their first two tournament games by an average of 28 points. For San Diego State coach Brian Dutcher, it will be a chance to get past a UConn program that beat the Aztecs, who are 26-10, and Kawhi Leonard in the 2011 Sweet 16 when the Huskies were led by Kemba Walker. In last year's championship game, UConn jumped out to a 16-point lead and never let San Diego State get within fewer than 5 points in the second half. This time, UConn will also be playing at the Boston Celtics TD Garden, just 85 miles from their campus. It's like a repeat. I mean, we've got to do what they did to us, Dutcher said. We're in their backyard now, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to beat them close to their home. Aztec senior Lamont Butler is embracing getting another shot at the Huskies. They took us down last year, so we definitely want some revenge back a little bit, he said.
Iowa's McCaffrey enters transfer portal. From the Associated Press, Iowa City. Iowa's Patrick McCaffrey, son of Hawkeyes coach Fran McCaffrey, has entered the transfer portal, the school confirmed Wednesday. Patrick McCaffrey has 1 year of eligibility remaining after starting 60 of 123 games. He was a starter for the first half of the 2023-24 season, averaged 8.9 points per game, and scored a team-high 19 in the Hawkeyes' loss at Utah in the NIT on Sunday. The 6'9", 212-pound forward had thyroid cancer when he was 13 and, after having two surgeries, was declared cancer-free 3 months after his diagnosis. He missed 6 games last season to address anxiety symptoms that caused him to lack sleep, appetite, and energy. McCaffrey, who took 2019-20 as a redshirt season, spent his first 3 years in the program with his older brother, Connor. Fran McCaffrey, 64, said last month that he has no plans to retire. 6 Cyclones at Big 12 Pro Day. Written for us by Dave Selvig of the Quad City Times. 6 Iowa State football players will participate in the first ever Big 12 Pro Day held in Frisco, Texas. Defensive back TJ Tampa, a projected first or second day pick, leads the Cyclones contingent. Also participating from Iowa State are kicker Chase Contreras, tight end Easton Dean, defensive back Ben Nickey, wide receiver Dimitri Stanley, and linebacker Gary Vaughn. I'm sorry, that's Jerry Vaughn. Tampa, a 6'2", 190-pound corner, had 44 tackles and 2 interceptions last season. ESPN draft analyst Mel Kiper has Tampa mocked to the Buffalo Bills with a 28th overall pick in his latest mock draft. Dean made 13 catches for 171 yards and 2 touchdowns last season for the Cyclones, who finished with a record 7-8. Stanley hauled in 15 balls for 139 yards. Vaughn made 46 tackles and had an INT, while Nickel made 40 tackles and broke up 3 passes. Contreras from Missouri Valley, Iowa, connected on 21 of 26 field goals, including 2 of 3 from 50-plus yards. On-field work in Frisco begins today and runs through Sunday at the Ford Center at the Star, the practice facility of the Dallas Cowboys. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Bob Wagner. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.